This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast. We're recording this podcast on September 25th. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. This week, we've got an exciting slate of topics to go over. First of all, I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about all the climate change news, particularly New York Climate Week with Greta Thunberg and all those sorts of things. We're also going to talk about
electric cars and give you an update. We keep hearing about electric cars and how generally, you're getting the perception that they're doing well. So we wanted to look at the actual numbers.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting to follow up. We did an electric car show. I don't know, but it's been probably been almost a year since we've done one. So be good to go over the numbers. So Climate Week, what was going on this week, Jackie?
Well, you can barely keep up with all the news headlines that are flowing through. There's many studies, many commitments going on. But I think one of the things that really caught a lot of people's attention was this 16-year-old Greta Thunberg giving an angry speech to world leaders at the UN.
Yeah, I've been following her actually for a few weeks now since she sailed across the Atlantic Ocean. And she's attracted a lot of publicity for sure, certainly on the pro-environmentalist side. She's now become a global icon, speaking at the United Nations, basically telling the world leaders to wake up, get on with it. We don't have any time. It's time to get to real solutions. You know, unfortunately, she's also taking a lot of very cynical and acidic criticism for a variety of reasons. I don't actually think we need to get into those reasons. You know, I'm going to give you my view, Jackie. I mean, I actually welcome what she's doing. And I welcome it because what she's doing is she's exposing the consumption side of the equation. You know, to this point, there's been a lot of the fingers pointing toward the upstream, toward the fossil fuels and so on. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. Okay. We talk about that ad nauseum on this show. But I think finally, we are seeing the culpability of the personal consumer enter into the discussion. And I think the turning point for that discussion actually happened back in December at the COP21 climate change conference in Poland, where Sir Attenborough opened up the proceedings with a speech that talked about how people should be or are willing now to take personal action. In other words, cut back on vacations, cut back on driving big vehicles, cut back on driving, and so on and so forth. And, you know, that message was, I think, a really important one. I think it was largely missed. But here comes then Greta Thunberg sailing across the ocean instead of taking a plane.
Yeah, it took 15 days to sail, and I don't think that would have been pleasant. So that is interesting, right? Not like jets setting in like many other of climate activists have done in the past, right?
Right. And, you know, a lot, as I said, she gets a lot of criticism for that. But I think to put that aside and just think about what she is actually exposing. She's actually exposing how committed we are or how addicted we are to fossil fuels, because normally you just take a jet and fly across the ocean, right? And so I think this is really an important moment in actually showing the depth to which we are on fossil fuels like oil and petroleum products, but more importantly, how difficult it actually is to get off of them. And to introduce this idea of personal culpability in being part of the solution if we are really intent on reducing emissions.
Right. And if you look at the emissions that are out there, you know, some are from industry for sure, and some are from utilities. Okay, indirectly consumers use electricity, but many of us don't choose where those electrons come from. But I'd say like about half of the emissions are things that we can change, like transportation emissions. You can reduce by the car you drive, or like you say, not choosing not to go on holidays and where you use fossil fuels, your home heating and how you heat your home, but also how hot you keep it and just being more efficient with the energy that you use. So there is about half of the emissions that I think consumers can directly impact.
Well, I've said, you know, it takes two to tango, you know, the old saying, because you've got both the supply side and the demand side. The supply side being upstream industrial usage and so on. And to this point, you know, a lot, if not all, of the headline narrative has been on that upstream part having to change, you know, through industrial carbon taxes and other aggressive spending that upstream industries need to take to lower their emissions. But it's impossible, looking at the numbers, to achieve the Paris targets with just an upstream effort. The downstream consumption has to be part of the solution as well.
Yeah, and I think Greta Thunberg, I mean, she has her critics, and I think this UN speech that she did this week was full of a lot of pretty depressing forecasts, like ecosystems collapsing, people suffering and dying. Like you say, what she's trying to do is get people to recognize that this is a big thing and everyone needs to change.
Yeah.
And so I think that is positive. Let's switch topics to a big announcement this week from Canada. So as part of Climate Week, we've seen many countries commit to net zero targets by 2050 for their economies. In fact, there was an announcement, 77 countries and over 100 cities had committed to this. And Canada yesterday joined that group. If the Liberals get elected, Canada will join that group, it seems, because the Liberals announced that if they are reelected, they will have a pledge to get to net zero by 2050 as well.
Right. So that means every industry, the whole country, individual, all the way from supply to consumption.
Well, it means that by 2050, if we were to achieve this, that if there are any CO2 molecules coming out of Canada directly in our boundaries, we would be offsetting that so that we'd have no emissions in aggregate. So for instance, you know, we would try to get zero emissions for as much as we could, but for those bit of emissions that we would have, we would be sequestering the CO2 or somehow offsetting the fact that we're creating
CO2. So 2050 is 30 years away. What do you think? Do you think this is possible?
It's a huge challenge. I mean, we emit a lot of CO2. We have a lot of industrial emissions. There would have to be massive changes to get to that. Or we would have to be sequestering a ton of CO2. And I mean, there are technologies that are really early stage, but are evolving in terms of sequestering. I did want to point out a not-for-profit called Energy Futures Initiative that's led by the former Secretary Ernie Moniz, also released a study this week as part of the New York Climate Research. Yes, the United States Secretary of Energy. He was formerly that. Now he's at MIT leading this Energy Futures Initiative. He put out a paper that we need to put $10 billion into sequestering CO2. It's required in terms of getting to these net zero targets. And I agree with him. But I think when we think of sequestering CO2, we think of just that one model where we take the CO2 from an industrial plant and we inject it geologically into a formation. He's talking about a way broader set of options, like injecting it into the ocean, into groundwater aquifers, making minerals. CO2 could be captured and then turned into a calcite, and that could be stored carbon. He's talking about creating these large biomass things, like maybe big ponds that would create seaweed that we would then bury, obviously planting trees, direct air capture. So if these technologies take off, I would feel more confident that net zero is possible because we could still be emitting CO2, but we would be injecting as much CO2 or storing as much.
I think it's possible, but really the technology is there. You just rattled off a whole suite of technologies. It's really about who's going to pay for it and the will to do it. And I think this comes back to the whole Thunberg, Attenborough, you know, that whole thing is there has to be a will among the people to A, pay for it, and B, ultimately the people are the consumers. And in many energy systems, it's the consumer that is responsible for the bulk of the emissions by the decisions they make, whether it's to flick a light switch or to turn the ignition key, assuming the upstream is dominantly fossil fuels, which it is. And so I, you know, $10 billion, okay, that's nice. You know, Germany committed 3-4 billion euros and things like that. And that's nice. And I don't want to rain on this rally, to be honest with you, but I got to be like, we've talked on this show that $300 billion a year is what the world is spending on renewable energy. Mm-hmm. And it's not even making a dent in the problem. So $10 billion, $3 billion, like you need a lot more to achieve the type of targets that we're talking about in the Paris Agreement, like way more.
Well, I think, you know, we need to invest in these technologies so that the costs come down and maybe that changes. But, you know, in terms of net zero, for sure, it's going to cost Canadians. But, you know, maybe Canadians are becoming okay with that. I don't know if you've looked at the more recent polling data. I just looked at the CBC poll tracker for September 24th. And like 2/3 of Canadians are voting left-leaning between the Liberal, NDP, and the Green vote. It's showing 2/3 of Canadians are leaning towards these type of policies. And I think that's why the Liberals announced this yesterday, is they think that appeals to Canadians.
Okay, fair enough. But I'm talking about, you know, it's easy to come out with these policies. It's easy to say I'm concerned personally. But then you get to question B, are you willing to pay for it? And are you willing to exercise discomfort in your lifestyle, make sacrifices, like not take a trip to Disneyland, like drive a smaller vehicle, live in a smaller home, put on a sweater instead of turning up the thermostat. You know, these are the kind of things that Attenborough in his speech are talking about. And he actually said in his speech, people are willing to do that. Well, some people are, but to achieve the Paris goals, a lot of people have to be. You know, I'm not trying to be cynical here. I'm trying to be a pragmatist, is that you can say you're going to exercise these policies, but ultimately it comes down to personal behavior and accountability to try and bring down these emissions to the targets that are being proposed in this very accelerated time frame. This is a very complicated problem. It's actually not a technological problem. It's a social problem, which is being discounted heavily, you know, the whole social side of this thing. And I think that when you get into the intersection of policy and social issues to address these environmental / energy issues, when the proverbial rubber hits the road, I think that there's going to be serious friction. I think that not enough time is being put into thinking about the social issues. There has to be a collaborative effort. If we're just barking at each other and arguing and getting angry, you know, this just creates a lot of animosity. And, you know, this is, you know, as I said, I am generally intrigued and welcome Greta Thunberg getting up on the stage and exposing the consumer side of business. But then there's a whole anger and antagonism, which just creates polarization. Like, that's not going to get us anywhere. That part of it's not going
to
get us anywhere.
Yeah, well, I think the feeling is things aren't moving fast enough, so we have to do that.
Yeah.
I want to come back to the net zero for Canada. I was, full disclosure, if I have an evening off, I just love watching the CBC National. I know okay. People out there are going to think I'm pretty exciting. So last night, watching the CBC National, because I have to hear about this net zero.
Okay, I read Twitter.
And they're talking about, they show the picture of downtown Calgary, and they're like, just the term net zero puts anxiety through the oil industry. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit. So yes, Canada has a lot of industrial emissions. About 40% of all of our emissions are from industry, a big chunk of those from the oil and gas industry. And, you know, what does the net zero mean to the Canadian oil and gas industry? You know, I think it's a challenge, but I think it is doable in that kind of time frame.
The 2050 time frame?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. We're going to learn more. But, you know, it was interesting last night, Derek Evans, the CEO of MEG, was on the CBC saying, you know, he could have a pilot maybe even in the next 18 to 24 months to prove it is possible to sequester CO2 in the oil sands region. We had Steve Lott on our show from CRL. Yeah. They've made a net zero target. It's going to be challenging, no doubt. But when you think about the technologies being involved and the abilities to sequester in that kind of time frame, I think it's going to take innovation, but I think our industry would have a chance, at least part of it, to be able to get there.
I think the technology is there. The cost is a big issue. What's it going to cost? But then there's circumstance, like where are you geographically located? Like some oil and gas companies are situated favorably to be able to do things like carbon sequestration. Others are not. Some have scale, others don't have scale. And by the way, you know, further to the whole liberal policy about net zero, this extends to all other industries too. You know, some cement plants may be favorably situated and some may not be. You know, some sit on granite and you can't drill and sequester the stuff. So where are you going to put it? I just think that the reality is that technologically it can be done, but there's a whole other series of layers of issues, which means that a certain segment of the industry will be able to do it actually far faster than people think.
Mm-hmm.
And some will never be able to do it.
Although that's where these technologies like the Energy Futures Initiative, and you can go download their report. I'll actually put a link to it. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to happen where you're emitting the CO2. You could be having big ponds where you're growing seaweed and burying the seaweed somewhere else in the world, right?
You could.
Yeah. You know, so
you could.
So,
I mean,
so there are like innovative ideas.
Which really begs the question, what is net zero? Right. I mean, that's a huge issue right there. How do you calculate net zero?
Yeah. And, you know, that is one thing. When people start throwing the term net zero around, I'm finding there are many different definitions when you actually start asking them.
Yeah.
But in my perspective, when it comes to Canada being net zero, it would be that for every CO2 molecule we put into the atmosphere, something's being sequestered. I would hope that that could also be outside of Canada because, you know, growing seaweed is in a tropical climate has got to be a lot more CO2 being sequestered than trying to do it in Canada, right? So we need some international agreements so that we can, for the lowest possible cost, offset those CO2 emissions.
Yeah, I mean, in the ideal utopian world, it would be absolute zero, right? You know, some energy systems are absolute zero.
Like renewables.
Yeah. Okay. Again, it depends how you define the boundary,
right.
You know, where you make the solar panels and all that stuff. But generally speaking, operationally, ideally, you would have absolute zero. But if you want to do this exercise, then you're going to have to adopt a collaborative multi-system approach, holistic approach to this thing. And as I said, I think some companies, MEG may be one of them, can do it. CNRL may be another, but others can't. And then, as I said, cross-industry, other emitters, just depends on circumstance, depends on availability of capital, depends on a whole series of
issues. Well, it depends on how some of these technologies, like we talked about that direct air capture, that Squamish BC company, and there are others that are doing it. Depends on the economics and energy associated with that and how that evolves. So yeah, we got some time, but I think there are some opportunities to, and you know, these types of policies will hopefully create the motivation and the innovation needed to find those technologies.
I mean, I would say the interesting observation is that the oil and gas industry has been under such acute pressure now for the better part of 10 years that they've been thinking about these issues, you know, sequestering carbon, cutting emissions through cutting operating costs and energy inputs, putting solar panels on their well sites, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, they have been part of this. As I look at other industries across Canada, I'm not convinced they're as far ahead. So to put net zero blanket across the country, I think there's going to be a pushback from other emitting industries more than potentially in the oil and gas business.
Yeah, I mean, the Liberals' plan doesn't have a lot of details, but you got to think about transportation even. Like, how would you do that? Well, I would think you'd probably have to say to all the auto dealers in Canada, you're only allowed to sell a very small amount of combustion vehicles.
Well, they're going to do that probably. Many countries are doing it by 2040.
You would say to the cities, no more combustion engines in your transportation. So all the buses have to be electric. There'd have to be a lot of mandates on every sector to force this to happen. Even, you know, that seems like a long ways away, but it takes a long time to turn over the fleets. So it has to be thought of fairly soon.
Right. I mean, it's one thing to say you have to sell only electric vehicles by, say, 2040. It's another thing to say there are no combustion vehicles in the fleet by such and such a time frame.
Yeah.
Like that's a much more aggressive target. But let's talk about electric vehicles.
Yeah, let's talk about electric. Okay, so we talked about energy disruptors last week, the conference held in Calgary, and I attended the electric car session and a lot of positive talk about how electric cars are really taking off, lots of models. So I wanted to go look into the numbers to see what the sales had been.
Yeah.
And so globally, over the first 7 months of 2019, they've sold 1.2 million EVs. That includes plug-ins and pure electric EVs. And that is up about 40% versus the same period last year. But it is actually a slowing pace of growth.
Yeah.
If you looked at that same period in 2018, it would have been up 64% year on year. So there's still growth, but there is actually a deacceleration
in the growth. We're going to post this chart, right?
Yeah, we could post the chart. It shows the global electric vehicle sales. And you can see there's been actually a very sharp fall off in July. And that is mainly related to the Chinese electric car sales, which in June, the Chinese announced that they are really cutting the subsidies. Some cars are no longer getting subsidies at all. Others are getting half of what they used to have. And the sales in China are actually lower right now than they were the same time last year for the last few months. And that's what's driven that number down.
Yeah, and that's actually kind of a uniform around the world in other countries like the United States and so on, which we'll talk about in a minute. But, you know, what I'm seeing here, if you look at this chart, is that, and it's a monthly chart, that typically in any year, you see sales increase all the way towards December, because that's when typically the incentive cycle runs out and then you start again.
Yeah, that profile was really driven by China, where they have some types of policies that incented more car sales at the end of the year.
But
you're seeing now zigzaggy and also falling to the same level as last year on the global basis. And when you look at China specifically, you'll see the sales have actually fallen under 2018
numbers.
Yeah,
on a month-to-month basis, the last couple of numbers. We'll see where it goes, but there's no question there's a deceleration. You know, part of that deceleration is also due to the Chinese economy and the global economy slowing. So there's less capital to buy all types of cars. But it's interesting how it's impacted the electric vehicles. It seems a little bit more potentially, which is an important lesson, because if you head into recession, then the propensity to adopt low or zero emission vehicles and just gadgets or infrastructure, build infrastructure diminishes.
Yeah, you just put off those
no
large
money,
purchases, right?
Yeah.
But I would say, you know, it's hard to know exactly what drives everything at this level, but I would say that this Chinese policy had a big impact because it really fell off the last few months. So that comes back to, they are not economic potentially without these subsidies, because you take the subsidies away and people stop buying them.
Well, I wouldn't say they're not economic. They're less economic. I mean, people are still buying them at a rate of around, I mean, I'm just going to eyeball it, $120,000 a month globally, right? Which, by the way, is just a drip in the bucket when you consider we have to swap out 2 billion vehicles around the world. You know, and that relates back to our previous discussion about making a personal decision about what kind of car you're going to buy if you are really committed to reducing climate change. And I think we should go look at some of the individual car models, because if we were having this conversation 3 or 4 years ago, you could legitimately say, well, I don't have very many options and the Tesla is way too expensive. Today, there's really no excuse. There is a multitude of models.
Well, there's 16 vehicles available in the U.S. We focused on the U.S. because it is, after China, the second largest electric vehicle market. But also, they have a lot more options than Canada does right now. 16 different vehicles available. You know, just we'll talk about the U.S. numbers. The U.S. is slowing a bit. So that's still growing, but not growing at the rate we've seen in previous years.
Yeah.
And it's worth pointing out that when you look at the individual model sales data, that's a good thing about the U.S. is we can get that level of granularity. More than half the sales are one model. So the Tesla Model 3. So if we take out the Tesla Model 3, we actually have less car sales this year than last year.
But even the Tesla Model 3 is falling off. I mean, we had a steady rise as it was introduced from January to May of this year, peaking at around 22,000 per month, it looks like to me, in May. But now it seems to have peeled back and leveled out around 13,000 a month. I mean, 2 points don't make a complete line, but it's consistent with the global data that the propensity to buy these vehicles has diminished. And that's in part because of the global economic slowdown. People aren't just not buying as many vehicles. But, you know, even if you look at the market share numbers of electric vehicle sales, they've dropped too.
Yeah. In fact, in the U.S., we're actually seeing market share decline, because although we continue to sell electric vehicles, we're selling more combustion vehicles. And so the market share has actually gone down year on year for the last year. I do want to point out, you know, I think economics are actually, it's all about the money. I think economics are the issue. If you look, and we're looking at U.S. dollar starting prices, you know, there's two categories of cars here. There's the luxury brands, which are $70,000 plus US, so very expensive cars. And then there's a whole group of cars, the majority of them are in this kind of mid $30,000 US range. And that includes the Nissan Leaf, Hyundai Kona, the VW e-Golf. So these cars, if you look at what they cost and then you compare it to a similar combustion engine vehicle, they're about two times the cost on average. And so, you know, you're saying, well, I'd love to buy an electric car, but do I really want to spend twice as much for something that maybe has a little bit less utility, depending on how I use it?
That's the capital cost, though. I mean, you know, like the if you go to the websites of a lot of these EV makers, they will correctly point out that, you know, you don't have maintenance, hardly any maintenance, and your operating cost is typically lower. In other words, quote, filling up is a fraction of the price.
Yeah, certainly we talked about that. It's, you know, maybe it's a few dollars to fill up your tank, but the reality is you paid so much more. And if you're only going to own the car for a certain amount of time, it's harder to justify. But I do want to talk about the Model 3, because I think it actually has the right price point. And I think that's why we're seeing sales. Now, it starts at $35,000, but I looked at the website. If you choose a longer battery range, which I think most people would want, and the higher performance features, it's about $55,000 US, which in Canada is about $75,000 Canadian. If I compare that to an Audi 4, which I think is comparable, so I looked at like the loaded Audi 4, I want your opinion on if that is a comparable car, because Peter's an expert here at the Model 3. But the A4 sells between $40,000 to $50,000 US dollars. So the Tesla is arguably in the range, if not a little bit cheaper than the A4. And I think that is why it's doing well. Because if you have money to spend on a car like that, you actually have the Tesla Model 3, which is comparable.
Yeah, it is comparable. I mean, I bought a Model 3 about 3 months ago, and I love it. I actually, this is my second electric vehicle. I traded in my Model X because I felt it was just too big. And I really like the size of the 3. And it is comparable to an Audi A4, the BMW 3 Series, the equivalent Lexus. You know, candidly, I don't know why you'd buy any one of those other cars if you can buy the Model 3, especially the performance version, because it'll beat the pants off it. It's quiet. And I think Tesla really has improved its fit, finish, and overall look, feel in this Model 3. So, you know, this is not an advertisement, but I got to say it's a compelling vehicle.
Right. And because like you're feeling like you're getting good value, right? It's not that you're paying twice as much like you are for these smaller cars that just aren't taking off.
Yeah. But, you know, that's me. You know, I am a convert. I think in part, yeah, the subsidies have waned in some parts of the world. It's still, the price is out of reach, but I still think there's resistance in terms of things like range, and people just fall back to what they know, or they want the growl of an engine or whatever. But I, you know, I want to get back to this. I keep coming back to the first part of the podcast. Like, if you are really willing and committed, if we are socially willing and committed to acting on climate change and achieving Paris targets, there's no excuse for not having choice. And yes, you will have to pay up at the moment. But if you're committed, that's what it takes, right? And, and I'm not trying to tell people what to do. I'm just saying that if you're committed, you can do it.
So you're saying, like Greta Thunberg would say, we all have to take some personal choice here, and it may mean buying a more expensive car because it's doing the right
thing. I'm not going to sail across the Atlantic, okay? And I'm sure 99.9% of people aren't.
Would you offset your emissions? Would you go buy some tree planting credits to offset your emissions for flying?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I haven't to date. I'd have to think about that. But the broader question posed to the public is, I think, you know, in the polls, they say, are you concerned about climate change? Majority of people will say yes in Western countries, including Canada. Then the secondary question is, well, how much are you willing to pay? Like, what was that poll that was put out a few weeks ago? Somebody said, you know, they asked that question. Then they asked, you know, are you willing to pay? And the long upshot of it was they weren't even willing to pay $100 a year, right? That's like a Netflix subscription equivalent. Well, you got to walk the talk, right? And that's my whole point is, I think what Greta Thunberg has done is exposed the consumption side of this problem.
Yeah.
And I think actually, I don't think people who are rallying and marching actually even fully realize that.
And I think the reality is that behaviors are actually going the other way, right? Oil demand keeps increasing year on year. Gas keeps increasing. And I wanted to point out one thing.
Look at this ridiculous chart. This ridiculous chart.
And maybe we can put this in as well. Maybe we'll make a series of charts associated with this. But U.S. light truck sales, the market share of large pickup trucks, SUVs, vans, it keeps increasing. So right now it's about 73% of July 2019 versus 65% a few years ago. Some things are just not lining up with the perception is not reality.
No, it's not. I wrote about this 10 years ago in my second book, End of Energy Obesity. And I noticed that, you know, for every increase in energy and fuel economy, it was offset by people buying bigger vehicles. Okay, fine. I'm not going to preach to you what to buy or what not to buy. The observation is that, again, it's not a technology problem. It's a social problem. It's one of personal choice. The business of energy is everybody's business. Because at the individual level, we are making choices about whether we flick the light switches on and on, turn the thermostat up or down, or the vehicle choices that we buy. And I think that in many ways, Greta has exposed this, right? And I think we're going to have some very interesting conversations going forward about personal accountability if we are ever going to meet these Paris targets.
Okay, well, we're running out of time. I think I just want to wrap up back to Climate Week and what you said. There's a strong message that more needs to be done. Looking at the electric car sales, we're not there yet. And I think I agree with many of the messages we're hearing this week that there's much more to do. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.